Morongo came to Muetsi in the hut. In the evening, Muetsi wanted to lie down on his side of the fire. Morongo said, "Do not lie over there. Lie with me." Muetsi lay down beside Morongo. Muetsi took the Ngona horn and put some ointment on his index finger. But Morongo said, "Don't be like that. I am not like Masasi. Now smear your loins with Ngona oil. Smear my loins with Ngona oil." Muetsi did as he was told. Morongo said, "Now couple with me." Muetsi coupled with Morongo. Muetsi went to sleep. Toward morning, Muetsi awoke. As he looked over to Morongo, he saw that her body was swollen. As day broke, Morongo began to give birth. The first day, Morongo gave birth to chickens, sheep, goats. The second night, Muetsi slept with Morongo again. The next morning, she bore eland and cattle. The third night, Muetsi slept with Morongo again. The next morning, Morongo bore first boys, then girls. The boys who were born in the morning were grown up by nightfall. On the fourth night, Muetsi wanted to sleep with Morongo again. But there came a thunderstorm, and Maori spoke, "Let be! You are going quickly to your death." Muetsi was afraid. The thunderstorm passed over. When it had gone, Morongo said to Muetsi, "Make a door, and then use it to close the entrance of the hut. Then Maori will not be able to see what we are doing. Then you can sleep with me." Muetsi made a door. With it, he closed the entrance to the hut. Then he slept with Morongo. Muetsi slept. Toward morning, Muetsi awoke. Muetsi saw that Morongo's body was swollen. As day broke, Morongo began to give birth. Morongo bore lions, leopards, snakes, and scorpions. Maori saw it. Maori said to Muetsi, "I warned you." On the fifth night, Muetsi wanted to sleep with Morongo again, but Morongo said, "Look, your daughters are grown. Couple with your daughters." Muetsi looked at his daughters. He saw that they were beautiful and that they were grown up, so he slept with them. They bore children. The children which were born in the morning were full grown by night, and so Muetsi became the Mambo, the king of a great people. But Morongo slept with the snake. Morongo no longer gave birth. She lived with the snake. One day, Muetsi returned to Morongo and wanted to sleep with her. Morongo said, "Let be." Muetsi said, "But I want to." He lay with Morongo. Under Morongo's bed lay the snake. The snake bit Muetsi. Muetsi sickened. The next day it did not rain. The plants withered. The rivers and lakes dried. The animals died. The people began to die. Many people died. Muetsi's children asked, "What can we do?" Muetsi's children said, "We will consult the Hakata, the sacred dice." The children consulted the Hakata, and the Hakata said, "Muetsi the Mambo is sick and pining. Send Muetsi back to the Tsivoa." Thereupon Muetsi's children strangled Muetsi and buried him. They buried Morongo with Muetsi. Then they chose another man to be Mambo. Morongo, too, had lived for 2 years in Muetsi's Zimbabwe. It is clear that each of the three stages of procreation represents an epoch in the development of the world. The wives and daughters of the Moon Man are the personifications and precipitators of his destiny. After the births from the elemental womb, the first two wives were pre-human and supra-human. But as the cosmogonic round proceeded, the mistresses of the cosmic births withdrew, and the field remained to the women of men. When at last he grew tired of the merely human and yearned back again to the wife of his abundance, the world sickened a moment under the pull of his reaction, but then released itself and ran free. Only humankind remained on the furnished earth. The cycle had moved on. The womb of redemption. The world of human life is now the problem. Society laps into mistake and disaster. The people yearn for some personality who, in a world of twisted bodies and souls, will represent again the lines of the incarnate image. We are familiar with the myth from our own tradition. Now on a certain day, while Mary stood near the fountain to fill her pitcher, the angel of the Lord appeared unto her, saying, "Blessed art thou, Mary, for in thy womb thou hast prepared a habitation for the Lord. Behold, light from heaven shall come and dwell in thee, and through thee shall shine in all the world." The story is recounted everywhere. Hindu mythology tells of the maiden Parvati, daughter of the mountain king Himalaya, who retreated into the high hills to practice very severe austerities. A tyrant titan named Taraka had usurped the mastery of the world, and according to the prophecy, only a son of the high god Shiva could overthrow him. Shiva, however, was aloof, alone, indrawn in meditation. It was impossible that Shiva should ever be moved to beget a son. Parvati determined to change the world situation by matching Shiva in meditation. Alone, aloof, indrawn into her soul, she too fasted naked beneath the blazing sun, even adding to the heat by building 4 additional great fires to each of the 4 quarters. The handsome body shriveled to a brittle construction of bones, the skin became leathery and hard, her hair stood matted and wild, the soft liquid eyes burned. One day, a Brahmin youth arrived and asked why anyone so beautiful should be destroying herself with such torture. "My desire," she replied, "is Shiva, the highest object. Shiva is a god of solitude and unshakable concentration. I therefore am practicing these austerities to move him from his state of balance and bring him to me in love." "Shiva," the youth said, "is a god of destruction. Shiva is the world annihilator. Shiva's delight is to meditate in burial grounds amidst the reek of corpses. There he beholds the rot of death, and that is congenial to his devastating heart. Shiva's garlands are of living serpents. Shiva is a pauper, furthermore, and no one knows anything of his birth." The virgin said, "He is beyond the mind of such as you, a pauper but the fountainhead of wealth, terrifying but the source of grace. Snake garlands or jewel garlands he can assume or put off at will. How should he have been born when he is the creator of the uncreated? Shiva is my love." The youth thereupon put away his disguise and was Shiva. The Buddha descended from heaven to his mother's womb in the shape of a milk-white elephant. The Aztec Cuitlicue was approached by a god in the form of a ball of feathers. Ovid's metamorphoses swarm with nymphs beset by gods in masquerades. Jove is a bull, a swan, a shower of gold. Any leaf accidentally swallowed, any nut, or even the breath of a breeze may be enough to fertilize the ready womb. The procreating power is everywhere, and according to the whim or destiny of the hour, either a hero-savior or a world-annihilating demon may be conceived. One can never know. Images of virgin birth abound in the popular tales as well as in myth. One example will suffice. A queer folk tale from Tonga, belonging to a little cycle of stories told of the handsome man, Sinilao. This tale is of particular interest because it clearly announces in unconscious burlesque every one of the major motifs of the typical life of the hero: virgin birth, quest for the father, ordeal, atonement with the father, the assumption and coronation of the virgin mother, and finally, the heavenly triumph of the true sons while the pretenders are heated hot. There was once a certain man and his wife, and the woman was pregnant. When her time came to be delivered of her child, she called her husband to come and lift her, that she might give birth. But she bore a clam, and her husband threw her down in anger. She, however, bade him take the clam and leave it in Sinilao's bathing pool. Now Sinilao came to bathe and flung the coconut husk that he had used to wash himself on the water. The clam slid along and sucked the coconut husk and became pregnant. One day the woman, the mother of the clam, saw the clam rolling along toward her. She angrily asked the clam why she had come, but the shellfish replied that it was no time for anger and asked her to curtain off a place in which she could give birth. So a screen was placed, and the clam gave birth to a fine big baby boy. Then she rolled back off to her pool, and the woman cared for the child. Time went on, and lo, the clam was again with child, and once more came rolling along to the house that she might give birth there to her child. The performance was repeated, and again the clam bore a fine boy. He too was left with the woman and her husband to be cared for. When the 2 children had grown up to manhood, the woman heard that Sinilao was going to hold a festival, and she determined that her 2 grandsons should be present. So she called the youths and bade them prepare, adding that the man to whose festival they were going was their father. When they came to where the festival was being held, they were gazed at by all the people. There was not a woman but had her eyes fixed on them. As they went along, a group of women called to them to turn aside to them, but the 2 youths refused and went on until they came to where the kava was being drunk. There they served the kava. But Sinilao, angry at their disturbing his festival, ordered 2 bowls to be brought. Then he bade his man seize one of the youths and cut him up. So the bamboo knife was sharpened to cut him, but when its point was placed on his body, it just slipped over his skin, and he cried out, "The knife is placed and slips. Do thou but sit and gaze at us, whether we are like thee or not." Then Sinilao asked what the youth had said, and they repeated the lines to him. So he ordered the 2 young men to be brought and asked them who their father was. They replied that he himself was their father. After Sinilao had kissed his newfound sons, he told them to go and bring their mother. So they went to the pool and got the clam and took her to their grandmother, who broke it open, and there stood a lovely woman named Hina at home in the river. Then they set out on their return to Sinilao. The two sons went ahead, and Hina followed. When they came to Sinilao, they found him sitting with his wives. The youths sat one at each thigh of Sinilao, and Hina sat at his side. Then Sinilao bade the people go and prepare an oven and heat it hot. And they took the wives and their children and killed and baked them. But Sinilao was wedded to Hina at home in the river. Transformations of the Hero, the third phase of the cosmogonic cycle. The third stage is the transformations of the hero, which traces the course of the legendary history of the human race through its typical stages, the hero appearing on the scene in various forms according to the changing needs of the race. We have come two stages, first from the immediate emanations of the uncreated creating to the fluid yet timeless personages of the mythological age, second, from these created creating ones to the sphere of human history. The cosmogonic cycle is now to be carried forward, therefore not by the gods, who have become invisible, but by the heroes, more or less human in character, through whom the world destiny is realized. This is the line where creation myths begin to give place to legend, as in the book of Genesis, following the expulsion from the garden. Metaphysics yields to prehistory. The heroes become less and less fabulous, until at last, in the final stages of the various local traditions, legend opens into the common daylight of recorded time. Now is required no incarnation of the moon bull, but a perfect human spirit alert to the needs and hopes of the heart. Accordingly, the cosmogonic cycle yields an emperor in human form who shall stand for all generations to come as the model of man the king. Childhood of the human hero. We shall consider first the miraculous childhood, by which it is shown that a special manifestation of the immanent divine principle has become incarnate in the world, and then the various life roles through which the hero may enact his work of destiny. King Sargon of Agade was born of a lowly mother. His father was unknown. Set adrift in a basket of bulrushes on the waters of the Euphrates, he was discovered by Aki, the husbandman, whom he was brought up to serve as gardener. The goddess Ishtar favored the youth. Thus he became at last king and emperor, renowned as a living god. Chandragupta, the founder of the Hindu Maurya dynasty, was abandoned in an earthly jar at the threshold of a cowshed. A herdsman discovered and fostered the infant. One day, when he was playing with his companions, a game of high king in the judgment seat, little Chandragupta commanded that the worst of the offenders should have their hands and feet cut off. Then, at his word, the amputated members immediately returned to place. A passing prince, beholding the miraculous game, bought the child for 1,000 harshapanas, and at home discovered by physical signs that he was Maurya. Pope Gregory the Great was born of noble twins who, at the instigation of the devil, had committed incest. His penitent mother set him to sea in a little casket. He was found and fostered by fishermen, and at the age of 6 was sent to a cloister to be educated as a priest. But he desired the life of a knightly warrior. Entering a boat, he was borne miraculously to the country of his parents, where he won the hand of the queen, who presently proved to be his mother. After discovery of this second incest, Gregory remained 17 years in penance, chained to a rock in the middle of the sea. The keys to the chains were tossed to the waters, but when, at the end of the long period, they were discovered in the belly of a fish, this was taken to be a providential sign. The penitent was conducted to Rome, where in due course he was elected pope. Charlemagne was persecuted as a child by his elder brothers and took flight to Saracen Spain. There, under the name of Mainet, he rendered signal services to the king. He converted the king's daughter to the Christian faith, and the two secretly arranged to marry. After further deeds, the royal youth returned to France, where he overthrew his former persecutors and triumphantly assumed the crown. Then he ruled 100 years, surrounded by a zodiac of 12 peers. According to all reports, his beard and hair were very long and white. One day, sitting under his judgment tree, he rendered justice to a snake, and in gratitude, the reptile bestowed on him a charm that involved him in a love affair with a woman already dead. After his long wars against the Saracens, Saxons, Slavs, and Northmen, the ageless emperor died, but he sleeps only, to awake in the hour of his country's need. During the later Middle Ages, he once arose from the dead to participate in a crusade. Each of these biographies exhibits the theme of the infant exile and return. This is a prominent feature in all legend, folktale, and myth. Usually, an effort is made to give it some semblance of physical plausibility. However, when the hero in question is a great patriarch, wizard, prophet, or incarnation, the wonders are permitted to develop beyond all bounds. The popular Hebrew legend of the birth of Father Abraham supplies an example of the frankly supernatural infant exile. The event of the birth had been read by Nimrod in the stars. For this impious king was a cunning astrologer, and it was manifest to him that a man would be born in his day who would rise up against him and triumphantly give the lie to his religion. He had a proclamation published throughout his whole kingdom, summoning all the architects to build a great house for him, 60 ells high and 80 wide. After it was completed, he issued a second proclamation, summoning all pregnant women thither, and there they were to remain until their confinement. Officers were appointed to take the women to the house, and guards were stationed in it and about it to prevent the women from escaping thence. He furthermore sent midwives to the house and commanded them to slay the men children at their mother's breasts. But if a woman bore a girl, she was to be arrayed in silk and embroidered garments and led forth from the house of detention amid great honors. No less than 70,000 children were slaughtered in this way. It was about this time that Terah espoused the mother of Abraham, and she was with child. When her time approached, she left the city in great terror and wandered toward the desert, walking along the edge of a valley until she happened to cross a cave. She entered this refuge, and on the next day she was seized with the throes, and she gave birth to a son. The whole cave was filled with the light of the child's countenance as with the splendor of the sun, and the mother rejoiced exceedingly. The babe she bore was our father Abraham. His mother lamented and said to her son, "Alas that I bore thee at a time when Nimrod is king. For thy sake 70,000 men children were slaughtered, and I am seized with terror on account of thee, that he hear of thy existence and slay thee. Better thou should perish here in this cave than my eyes should behold thee dead at my breast." She took the garment in which he was clothed and wrapped it about the boy. Then she abandoned him in the cave, saying, "May the Lord be with thee. May he not fail thee nor forsake thee." Thus Abraham was deserted in the cave without a nurse, and he began to wail. God sent Gabriel down to give him milk to drink, and the angel made it to flow from the little finger of the baby's right hand, and he sucked it until he was 10 days old. Then he arose and walked about, and he left the cave and went along the edge of the valley. When the sun sank and the stars came forth, he said, "These are the gods." But the dawn came, and the stars could be seen no longer, and then he said, "I will not pay worship to these, for they are no gods." Thereupon the sun came forth, and he spoke, "This is my God, him will I extol." But again the sun set, and he said, "He is no god." And beholding the moon, he called him his god, to whom he would pay divine homage. Then the moon was obscured, and he cried out, "This too is no god, there is one who sets them all in motion." The Blackfeet of Montana tell of a young monster slayer, Kuto Yis, who was discovered by his foster parents when the old man and woman put a clot of buffalo blood to boil in a pot. Immediately there came from the pot a noise as of a child crying, as if it were being hurt, burnt, or scalded. They looked in the kettle and saw there a little boy, and they quickly took it out of the water. They were very much surprised. Now, on the fourth day, the child spoke and said, "Lash me in turn to each of these lodge poles, and when I get to the last one, I shall fall out of my lashing and be grown up." The old woman did so, and as she lashed him to each lodge pole, he could be seen to grow, and finally, when they lashed him to the last pole, he was a man. The folk tales commonly support or supplant this theme of the exile with that of the despised one, or the handicapped, the abused youngest son or daughter, the orphan, stepchild, ugly duckling, or the squire of low degree.
There's an American Indian story of Waterjaw Boy. It's a story of the Tewa Pueblo Indians of New Mexico. It is of a girl whose mother was stirring mud to make jars. and she was going to the well to get some more water, and she put her daughter to work stirring this with her foot. And as the girl was stirring the mud, some of it splashed up and struck her on the high thigh. As this text said, none of it got into the girl. Well, somehow or other, it impregnated her, and she presently gave birth to a child. Only it was not the normal-looking child. It was a little water jar. The mother hadn't known until the birth that her daughter was pregnant, and she was mortified that she should have given birth to a jar. And when the girl's father came in, the mother said, well, the daughter's had a child. And he said, I'm very glad she had a child. But he said, it isn't a real child, it's a little jar. Well, the little jar could talk, and it was a little boy. And the grandfather was very, very taken by this little boy, this little jar boy. He liked it very much.
Pretty soon, that little water jar was growing. In 20 days, it was big. It was able to go around with the children, and it could talk. Grandfather, take me outdoors so I can look around, he said. So every morning, the grandfather would take him out, and he would look at the children, and they were very fond of him, and they found out he was a boy. Water jar boy. They had found out from his talking. In sum, the child of destiny has to face a long period of obscurity. This is a time of extreme danger, impediment, or disgrace. He is thrown inward to his own depths or outward to the unknown. Either way, what he touches is a darkness unexplored. The myths agree that an extraordinary capacity is required to face and survive these experiences. The infancies abound in anecdotes of precocious strength, cleverness, and wisdom. Heracles strangled a serpent sent against his cradle by the goddess Hera. Maui of Polynesia snared and slowed the sun to give his mother time to cook her meals. Abraham arrived at the knowledge of the one God. Jesus confounded the wise men. The baby Buddha had been left one day beneath the shade of a tree. His nurses suddenly noted that the shadow had not moved all afternoon, and that the child was sitting fixed in a yogic trance. The conclusion of the childhood cycle is the return of recognition of the hero when, after the long period of obscurity, his true character is revealed. This event may precipitate a considerable crisis, for it amounts to an emergence of powers hitherto excluded from human life. This theme of crucifixion-resurrection can be illustrated either on the body of the hero himself or in his effects upon the world. The first alternative we find in the Pueblo story of the water jar.
And the jar grew up a little bit, and when it got to be so big, it said, I want to go down to the flat to hunt. The father said, you can't hunt. You don't have any arms and legs. Well, he said, take me down anyhow. So the mother let them go, and the father took them down. And then the child saw a jackrabbit and started rolling after the jackrabbit. And the jar hit a rock and broke. And out jumped a beautiful boy with all the turquoise earrings and bangles and things that go with being a Navajo. And he spent the day hunting for rabbits. Then the grandfather became a little bit anxious because the boy wasn't returning, and presently he sees a boy, a beautiful boy, with a lot of rabbits coming down the road. And the father says, grandfather says, have you seen my son anywhere, my grandson anywhere? He's a kind of water jar. And the boy said, no, I haven't seen your grandson anywhere. And when he saw his grandfather becoming very sad about that, he said, I'm your grandson.
He returned and presented a number of rabbits to his grandfather, who brought him triumphantly home. The cosmic energies burning within the vivid Irish warrior Cuchulainn would suddenly burst like an eruption, both overwhelming himself and smashing everything around. When he was 4 years old, so the story goes, he set out to test the boy Cor of his uncle, King Conchobar, at their own sports. Carrying his hurley of brass, ball of silver, throwing javelin and toy spear, he proceeded to the city court of Emania, where, without so much as a word of permission, he dived right in among the boys, 50 in number, who were hurling on the green and practicing martial exercises with Conchobar's son, Folomain, at their head. The whole field let fly at him. With his fists, forearms, palms, and little shield, he parried the hurleys, balls, and spears that came simultaneously from all directions. Then, for the first time in his life, he was seized with his battle frenzy, and before anyone could grasp what was coming to pass, he had laid low 50 of the best. Cuchulainn's first day under arms was the occasion of his full self-manifestation. The happening was again at the court of King Conchobar, the day Cathbad the Druid declared in prophecy of any stripling who that day should assume arms and armature that the name of such an one would transcend those of all Ireland's youths besides. His life, however, would be fleeting short. Cuchulain forthwith demanded fighting equipment. 17 sets of weapons given him he shattered with his strength, until Conchobar invested him with his own outfit. Cuchulain commanded Conchobar's charioteer to drive him past the distant lookout ford, and they came presently to a remote fortress where he cut off the heads of the defenders. He fastened the heads to the sides of the car. On the road back, he jumped to the ground and by sheer running and mere speed captured 2 stags of the grandest bulk. With 2 stones he knocked out of the air 2 dozen flying swans, and with thongs and other gear he tethered all, both the beasts and the birds, to the chariot. Levarcan the prophetess beheld the pageant with alarm as it approached the castle of Emania. "The chariot is graced with bleeding heads of his enemies," she declared. "Beautiful white birds he has, which in the chariot bear him company, and wild unbroken stags bound and tethered to the same." "I know that chariot fighter," the king said. "Should his fury not be timely met, all Emania's young men will perish by him." Very quickly, a method had to be contrived to abate his heat, and one was found. 150 women of the castle, and Shandlock, their leader, at the head of them, reduced themselves critically to nature's garb, and without subterfuge of any kind, trooped out to meet him. The little warrior, embarrassed, or perhaps overwhelmed by such a display of womanhood, averted his eyes, at which moment he was seized by the men and soused into a vat of cold water. The staves and hoops of the vessel flew asunder. A second vat boiled, a third became only hot. Thus Cuchulain was subdued and the city saved. A beautiful boy indeed was that. 7 toes to each foot Cuchulain had, and to either hand as many fingers. His eyes were bright with 7 pupils apiece, each one of which glittered with 7 gem-like sparkles. On either cheek he had 4 moles, a blue, a crimson, a green, and a yellow. But when he was taken by his paroxysm or distortion, he became a fearsome and multiform and wondrous and hitherto unknown being. All over him, from his crown to the ground, his flesh and every limb and joint and point and articulation of him quivered. His feet, shins, and knees shifted themselves and were behind him. The frontal sinews of his head were dragged to the back of his neck, where they showed in lumps bigger than the head of a man-child aged 1 month. One eye became engulfed in his head so far that 'tis a question whether a wild heron could have got at it where it lay against his occiput to drag it out upon the surface of his cheek. The other eye, on the contrary, protruded suddenly and of itself so rested upon the cheek. His mouth was twisted awry till it met his ears. Flakes of fire streamed from it. The Hero as Warrior. The place of the hero's birth, or the remote land of exile from which he returns to perform his adult deeds among men, is the midpoint or navel of the world. Just as ripples go out from an underwater spring, so the forms of the universe expand in circles from this source. Above the broad, unmoving depths, beneath the 9 spheres and the 7 floors of heaven, at the central point, the world navel, the quietest place on the earth, where the moon does not wane nor the sun go down, where eternal summer rules and the cuckoo everlastingly calls, there the white youth came to consciousness. So begins a hero myth of the Yakuts of Siberia. The white youth went forth to learn where he was and what his dwelling place was like. Eastward of him lay stretching a broad fallow field, in the middle of which arose a mighty hill, and on the summit of the hill a gigantic tree. The summit of the tree rose over the 7 heaven floors and served as a tethering post for the high god, while the roots penetrated into subterranean abysses where they formed the pillars of the dwellings of the mythical creatures proper to that zone. The tree held conversation through its foliage with the beings of the sky. When the white youth turned to face south, he perceived in the midst of a grassy green plain the quiet lake of milk that no breath of wind ever stirs. To the north of him, a somber forest stood with trees that rustled day and night, and therein was moving every kind of beast. A thicket of scrub stretched out to the west, and beyond it stood a forest of tall firs. This was the manner, then, of the world in which the white youth beheld the light of day. Presently tired, however, of being alone, he went over to the gigantic tree of life. "Honored High Mistress, mother of my tree and my dwelling place," he prayed. "Everything that lives exists in pairs and propagates descendants. But I am alone. I want to travel now and to seek a wife of my own kind. I wish to measure my strength against my kind. I want to become acquainted with men, to live according to the manner of men. Do not deny me thy blessing. I do humbly pray. I bow my head, and I bend my knee." Then the leaves of the tree began murmuring, and a fine milk-white rain descended from them upon the white youth. A warm breath of wind could be felt. The tree began to moan, and out of its roots a female figure emerged to the waist, a woman of middle age, with earnest regard, her hair flowing free, her bosom bare. The goddess offered her milk to the youth from a sumptuous breast, and after partaking of it, he felt his strength increase 100-fold. At the same time, the goddess promised the youth every happiness and blessed him in such a way that neither water, nor fire, iron, nor anything else should ever do him harm. From the umbilical spot, the hero departs to realize his destiny, his adult needs pour creative power into the world. The world period of the hero in human form begins only when villages and cities have expanded over the land. Many monsters remaining from primeval times still lurk in the outlying regions. They have to be cleared away. Furthermore, tyrants arise and are the cause of widespread misery. They have to be suppressed. The elementary deeds of the hero are those of clearing the field. Blood Clot Boy. When he had been taken from the pot and had grown to manhood in a day, slew the murderous son-in-law of his foster parents, then proceeded against the ogres of the countryside. He exterminated a tribe of cruel bears, with the exception of one female who was about to become a mother. She pleaded so pitifully for her life that he spared her. If he had not done this, there would have been no bears in the world. Then he slaughtered a tribe of snakes, but again, with the exception of one, who was about to become a mother. Next, he deliberately walked along a road which he had been told was dangerous. As he was going along, a great windstorm struck him, and at last carried him into the mouth of a great fish. This was a sucker fish, and the wind was its sucking. When he got into the stomach of the fish, he saw a great many people. Many of them were dead, but some were still alive. He said to the people, "Ah, there must be a heart somewhere here. We will have a dance." So he painted his face white, his eyes and mouth with black circles, and tied a white rock knife on his head so that the point stuck up. Some rattles made of hooves were also brought. Then the people started into dance. For a while, Blood Clot sat making wing motions with his hands and singing songs. Then he stood up and danced, jumping up and down until the knife on his head struck the heart. Then he cut the heart down. Next, he cut through between the ribs of the fish and let all the people out. Again, Blood Clot said he must go on his travels. Before starting, the people warned him, saying that in a while he would see a woman who was always challenging people to wrestle with her, but that he must not speak to her. He gave no heed to what they said, and, after he had gone a little way, he saw a woman who called him to come over. "No," said Blood Clot, "I am in a hurry." However, the fourth time the woman asked him to come over, he said, "Yes, but you must wait a little while, for I am tired. I wish to rest. When I have rested, I will come over and wrestle with you." Now, while he was resting, he saw many large knives sticking up from the ground, almost hidden by straw. Then he knew that the woman killed the people she wrestled with by throwing them down on the knives. When he was rested, he went on. The woman asked him to stand up in the place where he had seen the knives, but he said, "No, I am not quite ready. Let us play a while before we begin." So he began to play with the woman, but quickly caught hold of her, threw her upon the knives, and cut her in two. Blood Clot took up his travels again, and after a while came to a camp where there were some old women. The old women told him that a little further on he would come to a woman with a swing, but on no account must he ride with her. After a time, he came to a place where he saw a swing on the bank of a swift stream. There was a woman swinging on it. He watched her for a while and saw that she killed people by swinging them out and dropping them into the water. When he found this out, he came up to the woman. "You have a swing here. Let me see you swing," he said. "No," said the woman, "I want to see you swing." "Well," said Bloodclot, "but you must swing first." "Well," said the woman, "now I shall swing. Watch me, then I shall see you do it." So the woman swung out over the stream, and as she did this, he saw how it worked. Then he said to the woman, "You swing again while I am getting ready." But as the woman swung out this time, he cut the vine and let her drop into the water. This happened on Cutbank Creek. We are familiar with such deeds from our Jack the Giant Killer nursery tales and the classical accounts of the labors of such heroes as Heracles and Theseus. They abound also in the legends of the Christian saints, as in the following charming French tale of Saint Martha. There was at the time on the banks of the Rhone, in a forest situated between Avignon and Arles, a dragon, half animal, half fish, larger than an ox, longer than a horse, with teeth as sharp as horns and great wings at either side of its body. And this monster slew all the travelers and sank all the boats. It had arrived by sea from Galatia. Its parents were the Leviathan, a monster in the form of a serpent that dwelt in the sea, and the Onager, a terrible beast bred in Galatia, which burns with fire everything it touches. Now Saint Martha, at the earnest request of the people, went against the dragon. Having found it in the forest in the act of devouring a man, she sprinkled holy water on it and exhibited a crucifix. Immediately, the monster, vanquished, came like a lamb to the side of the saint, who passed her belt around its neck and conducted it to the neighboring village. There, the populace slew it with stones and staffs. And since the dragon had been known to the people under the name of Tarasque, the town took the name of Tarascon in remembrance. The warrior kings of antiquity regarded their work in the spirit of the monster slayer. This formula, indeed, of the shining hero going against the dragon has been the great device of self-justification for all the Crusades. The hero as lover. The hegemony wrested from the enemy, the freedom won from the malice of the monster, the life energy released from the toils of the tyrant is symbolized as a woman. She is the maiden of the innumerable dragon slayings, the bride abducted from the jealous father, the virgin rescued from the unholy lover. She is the other portion of the hero himself. The magnificent youth, Cahulain, at the court of his uncle, Conchobar the king, aroused the anxiety of the barons for the virtue of their wives. They suggested that he should be found a wife of his own. Her name was Emer, and he found her on her playing field with her foster sisters around her, teaching them needlework and fine handiwork. Emer lifted up her lovely face and recognized Cahulain, and she said, "May you be safe from every harm." When the girl's father, Forgil the Wily, was told that the couple had talked together, he contrived to send Cahulain off to make the impossible journey to a certain warrior woman, Skatash, and then compel her to give him instruction in her arts of supernatural valor. Cahulain's hero journey exhibits with extraordinary simplicity and clarity all the essential elements of the classic accomplishment of the impossible task. The way was across a plain of ill luck. On the hither side of it, the feet of men would stick fast. On the farther side, the grass would rise and hold them fast on the points of its blades. But a fair youth appeared who presented to Cahulain a wheel and an apple. Across the first part of the plain, the wheel would roll just ahead, and across the second, the apple. Cahulain had only to keep to their thin guiding line, without a step to either side, and he would come across to the narrow and dangerous glen beyond. The residence of Skatach was on an island, and this island was approached by a difficult bridge, and whenever anybody leaped on one end of it, the other end would lift itself up and throw him on his back. Cahulain was thrown 3 times. Then his distortion came upon him, and gathering himself, he jumped on the head of the bridge and made the hero's salmon leap so that he landed on the middle of it, and the other head of the bridge had not fully raised itself up when he reached it and threw himself from it and was on the ground of the island. The warrior woman, Skatach, had a daughter, as the monster so often has, and this young maid, in her isolation, had never beheld anything approaching the beauty of the young man who came down from the mid-air into her mother's fortress. When she had heard from the youth what his project was, she described to him the best manner of approach to persuade her mother to teach him the secrets of supernatural valor. He should go through his hero's salmon leap to the great yew tree where Scathach was giving instruction to her sons, set his sword between her breasts, and state his demand. Cuchulainn, following instructions, won from the warrior sorceress acquaintance with her feats, marriage to her daughter without payment of a bride price, knowledge of his future, and sexual intercourse with herself. He remained a year, during which he assisted in a great battle against the Amazon, Aife, on whom he begot a son. Finally, slaying a hag who disputed with him a narrow path along the edge of the cliff, he started home for Ireland. One further adventure of battle and love, and Cuchulainn returned to find Forgall the Wily still against him. He simply carried the daughter off this time, and they were married at the court of the king. The adventure itself had given him the capacity to annihilate all opposition. The only annoyance was that Uncle Conchobar, the king, exercised on the bride his royal prerogative before she passed officially to the groom. The motive of the difficult task as prerequisite to the bridal bed has spun the hero deeds of all time and all the world. In stories of this pattern, the parent is in the role of holdfast. The hero's artful solution of the task amounts to a slaying of the dragon. The tests imposed are difficult beyond measure. They seem to represent an absolute refusal on the part of the parent ogre to permit life to go its way. Nevertheless, when a fit candidate appears, no task in the world is beyond his skill. Unpredicted helpers, miracles of time and space, further his project. Destiny itself, in the form of the maiden, lends a hand and betrays a weak spot in the parental system. The hero as emperor and as tyrant. The supreme hero is not the one who merely continues the dynamics of the cosmogonic round, but he who reopens the eye. The characteristic adventure of the first is the winning of the bride, for the bride is life. The adventure of the second is the going to the father, for the father is the invisible unknown. Adventures of the second type fit directly into the patterns of religious iconography. Even in a simple folk tale, a depth is suddenly sounded when the son of the virgin one day asks of his mother, "Who is my father?" Where the goal of the hero's effort is the discovery of the unknown father, the basic symbolism remains that of the tests and the self-revealing way. The familiar myth motifs of the atonement inevitably follow.
Please fast forward to the end and turn the tape over for proper cueing of side four.